Good morning and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. America has been praised as an exceptional country, a classless society with endless opportunities where anyone can succeed if only they will work hard enough. Well, prepare to be disabused of that idea today. Our guest is Nancy Eisenberg, and she argues that that whole notion is bad history, to say the least. She says that class separation is and always has been at the center of our history, our culture, our economy, and our politics. Nancy Eisenberg has written a new book. It's called, provocatively enough, White Trash: The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. And in it, she debunks some very popular myths, and she shows just how thoroughly the notion of class is woven right into our national fabric. And she looks at this through the prism of the poor white population in our country, starting from colonial times right to the present. Nancy Eisenberg is the T. Harry Williams Professor of History at Louisiana State University. She's the author of a number of books. Her most recent, again, White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. And she's joining us from the studios of WVTF in Charlottesville in Virginia. Nancy, thanks so much for being here. What a timely visit.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's start with what sparked the idea for the book. You've got something like 23 pages of footnotes alone, so clearly there was a lot of grist for your mill.
Yes. And part of the reason I got interested in this topic is the last book that I wrote with my partner, Andrew Burstein, was called Madison and Jefferson. And I became very interested in how Jefferson talked about class, because usually it's portrayed as if he supported the yeoman farmer and that somehow that was the central theme of his endorsement for democracy. But that really misses the way in which Jefferson talked about class. Jefferson referred to poor whites in Virginia as rubbish. And this is a really important theme that I trace all the way back to English ideas that were firmly implanted during the period of British colonization. And that is that the poor were considered expendable. They were referred to by one of the leading promoters of colonization as waste people. And the theme, and this is, I think, something that Americans really don't understand, the theme that the British put forward is that the expendable people in England, the people who were not productive, the people who were not contributing to the economy, could literally be dumped into the New World. And that same idea is the same idea that Americans had when they thought about opening up the frontier. That what Jefferson actually argued, he never argued for upward mobility. What Jefferson and Franklin both argued is the idea that what would be provided was not class mobility, but horizontal mobility. The idea of the frontier opened, people would be able to move west. If they weren't making it on the states on the East Coast, somehow they would find opportunity in the West. But that proved not to be true either, because in the West, powerful land speculators, powerful landholders, again, had the advantage, and the poor were marginalized, pushed to the worst land. And as Franklin argued, Franklin basically said, if you can't make it, you have two options. Either you work hard, you move on, or you die.
Well, you've kind of just ruined Thanksgiving for a lot of us, Nancy, because we just love the idea that this plucky band of Puritans sailed to America for religious freedom and were greeted by Native Americans who showed them how to grow maize. And I mean, the whole idea that British investors were, or European investors in general, actually, were looking for a place to invest their money, and they were willing to put people that they considered, as you say, waste people and rubbish on boats on a dangerous journey to send them over to sort of plow the land and prepare for the investment class.
Right. And that's one of the things. Even Jonathan Winthrop believed that the real attraction of the New World was land. And this is one of the things we have to realize. Land was the most important basis for Economic wealth, economic status, even the right to vote was first defined by people who owned land. So the landless essentially were seen as worthless. And what we forget about the Puritans, at the time of Winthrop's Great Migration, the majority of people who went over to the New World, even to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, were not Puritans. Most of them were poor. And a lot of, this is, I think, the most disturbing part, is that a lot of the people who were being sent to the New World, those who became what were known as indentured servants, and indentured servitude meant that you were locked in to labor and be a servant for a master from 7 to 9 years, and most of them were children. Most of them were young boys. And guess what? The ones who were sent to places like Virginia, where the climate was horrible, didn't even live to adulthood. So this is part of the darker side, exploiting child labor, and that also laid the foundation for slavery, because slavery was also about exploiting child labor. So we have to sort of realize that the myth of religious liberty really only reflected a small majority of the people who ended up coming to the New World.
Well, we're going to talk a bit about how race and class have overlapped in our history, and but I think I really want to get to first the title. I have a hunch that you knew that it would stop people in their tracks in the bookstores, of course, because that certainly has never had a particularly positive connotation. It's you have a whole list of words that have always referred to poor whites, from white trash to off-scourings, lubbers, bog trotters, rascals, rubbish, squatters, crackers, clay eaters, tackies, mudsills, scalawags, brian hoppers, lowdowners, and hillbillies. So this particular class has been with us under different names for a very long time.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that it's really important to understand about doing good history, is you don't mask the language. And even some historians have done this. For example, when they talk about the pioneers, or they talk about settlers moving west, settler is a neutral term, when in fact the terms that were used to describe the poor migrants who moved into the backcountry, places like Tennessee, Kentucky, early Ohio, Indiana, were referred to as squatters and crackers. And when we cover up our language, when we refuse to acknowledge the words and the vocabulary, the taxonomy that was prevalent and widely used, we erase part of our past. And all those terms that you highlight show the repeated notion that for the poor, first of all, they were usually identified with being idle, like lazy lubbers, or they were identified with trash, as we see the word rubbish. Rascal, that word actually comes from the English notion of trash. Or they were associated with wastelands. Wastelands is the agricultural notion of lands that were left fallow, that weren't productive. So the poor who were landless were seen extrusions of the worst land possible. So they're associated with swamps. They're associated, like hillbillies, with, you know, poor land in the hills. Or the word redneck, believe it or not, by the late 19th century was associated with people who lived in swamps. And then finally, the theme that is used over and over again is to associate the poor with defective animal breeds, as you said, briar hoppers, or tackies, which was an inferior breed of horse found on the marshes of Carolina. So the two themes that I highlight is the idea of wastelands, land, and how that defined class identity, and then breeding and breeds. And this, unfortunately, laid the foundation for the incredibly and sadly popular eugenics movement. That if we think about class as a distinct breed of people, essentially that endorses the idea that these people can never be fully assimilated into normal society. And charity is worthless. You can't help them because they pass on their defective traits from one generation to the next. And that was widely prevalent and widely endorsed from people of all classes, particularly even a very famous president, Theodore Roosevelt, who was a prominent eugenicist.
Well, your book begins in the 1500s with the colonization of North America by England. And from the very beginning, there was a talk of arranging marriages to make sure that you were maintaining a so-called pedigree. So it was almost like animal husbandry So how is it that when we got this kind of start with an assumption, a base assumption that the poor will always be poor because they intermarry with poor and poor begets poor, and this whole idea that America is a place of upward mobility?
Yeah, this is the other thing we forget. I mean, this is a classic English notion, the idea of paying attention to pedigree, lineage, the marrying into the right class. And in fact, we still consider class when we get married today. All you have to do is look at computer dating. There are sites like goodgenes.com where you can find another Ivy Leaguer.
Ooh,
and in
never
fact,
heard
the
of
founder,
that.
Yeah, the founder of computer dating was a man who started his career in eugenics, then moved on to marriage counseling, and then in 1956 promoted computer dating. And if you think about what computer dating is, it's about matching traits. And what are the most important traits? Your tastes. They're class-based. Your education, that's class-based. Your hobbies, those are class-based. So in fact, we still very much rely on class identity as a way that's still woven into the way we choose who we want to marry.
So where did the idea that this is a classless culture and society come from?
Right. Well, it has various it sort of gets promoted at several points. I talked about Franklin and Jefferson, who believed that essentially class horizontal mobility would reduce class tension. Franklin referred to creating a happy mediocrity, that if people were spread out across the vast continent, that would sort of reduce class tension. But as I also highlighted, that did not really reduce class tension. That was Franklin imagining a future that never happened. And then you referred to the idea of Jefferson's idea of creating a natural aristocracy. He was heavily interested in breeding, in breeding sheep, and he applied the same ideas to talk about how you would create a natural aristocracy. He basically had an argument with John Adams in 1813, where he was saying that no, people would not just marry for money. That the man, of course, who he's talking about, would pick mates who had other traits such as virtue, intelligence, beauty. But what he was highlighting is that to create a natural aristocracy, it meant the best of the best would breed and create another generation of the most talented people, our idea of a meritocracy, which in a sense he was saying this would be a matter of biology that would create this. But then at the same time, he was not acknowledging the fact that the people who were poor, the people who were marrying among the poorer classes, were essentially not going to be involved in that promise of upward mobility. So we find this idea of how class gets constructed. And one of the solutions we see with Jefferson is to say, oh, it's about nature, that nature determines class. But in fact, it's not nature. It's the way culture reinforces class notions. Where the classless society becomes really popular is in the 1950s. I mean, it was actually Richard Nixon, when he was over in Moscow promoting the promise of American capitalism. And he gave a talk, and he was accompanied by a symbol of American success, which was a ranch home in suburbia. And he basically argued, now America, capitalism had finally created a classless society, and that was rooted again in property. It was rooted in being able to buy a suburban home. But as I also highlight, at the same time we had the growth of suburbia, guess what suburbia came with it? Class-zoned neighborhoods, or one-class communities. And then at the same time, you had the growth of the trailer park, which were in the worst places on the margins of society. And there you created what sociologists by the 1970s called hillbilly havens. So even suburbia, in the sense the idea that everyone could buy a home, that is still a measure of middle-class attainment. But we also have to realize that where we think that was its most successful in the 50s and the 60s, we still were replicating a class division with the growth of trailer parks and the new nomenclature, trailer trash.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit, Nancy, about the overlap and intertwining and even conflation of race differentiation and class differentiation?
Yeah, I talk a lot about this because even theories of race and class get intertwined. I talk about, particularly in the antebellum period, with the period of manifest destiny, the kind of pervasive racism that was so popular. This is where prominent spokespeople began, and we're talking about politicians, intellectuals, began arguing that, you know, America would be great because we were predominantly an Anglo-Saxon society. That idea was used in the war against Mexico and the acquisition of Texas and California. So the idea that one would sort of focus on the how do you include racial different populations? Well, guess what again was revived in this period of manifest destiny? In order to endorse the annexation of Texas, the prominent Mississippi senator argued that we can add Mexico because essentially we're still going to be incorporating a large number of people who came from the United States, people of good Anglo-Saxon stock. But then they also began to argue that essentially free blacks would magically migrate into South America. The Texas, that idea that South America was going to be a receptacle for the refuse, and that somehow, again, nature and the way in which we think of people as nomads would magically, you know, rearrange the racial differences in society. And that same idea would be applied again and again to poor whites. In fact, the prominent critic and intellectual who defined Southern society and published his book in 1860, Daniel Hundley, used exactly the same argument. He said that in the South, you know, white trash were at the bottom. He had two poor white groups. He had mean whites, who he called bullies, and then he had white trash at the bottom, who were pathetic. And he revived that same idea and argued that we don't have to worry about, you know, the increasing numbers of poor whites in the South, which did increase substantially in the antebellum period. But he said, yes, like nomads, they too would magically migrate out of the South into South America. So right from the beginning, the idea of race, the idea of breeding, these ideas of race and class get intertwined. We also know that politicians have manipulated tensions between poor whites and poor blacks. I highlight the important careers of James Vardaman, who essentially was known as supposedly referred to as the white chief and seen as a kind of witch doctor who was, you know, revving up the poor white trash in his state of Mississippi. And I highlight, I think, you know, one of the best examples of this idea was the idea that was articulated by Lyndon Johnson. And he made this point very clear when he was traveling through Kentucky and he saw poor white protesters who were protesting against civil rights. And he made an idea, sadly enough, that was the same idea that John Adams had made in 1790. In 1790, John Adams argued that Americans not only scrambled to get ahead, they needed someone to disparage. And this is what he wrote. He said, there must be one, indeed one, who was the last and lowest of the human species. And he was saying they needed to be able to look down on that person. Lyndon Johnson, in explaining the racism of poor whites, said this: if you can convince the lowest white man he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. Hell, give him someone to look down on and he'll empty his pockets for you. And this is something that's been true about American politics, is the idea that Southern white Democrats and other politicians fuel racial conflict between poor blacks and whites in order to redirect the anger of the lower classes away from the white elite. And this is something Lyndon Johnson only knew too well.
So this doesn't just end in the 1500s or the 1700s. It goes all the way up to our current politics. That is a very, very telling quote from LBJ. Hell, if you give him somebody to look down on and he will empty his pockets for you. Arguably, that is something that dates back to the 1500s when, in fact, so-called poor white trash was considered actually below slaves. Isn't that right?
Right. And this is the other thing people don't realize, is that in the antebellum South, prominent elite planters were more than willing to see their slaves as being useful because they were part of the economy, where they actually saw poor whites as outsiders. And this is where we see the rise of some of the worst names, where they're called sandhillers, again identifying them with poor land, clay eaters, where they begin to be described as not even white, as having a yellow tallow color to their skin. Their children are described as almost looking like albinos, where they have white hair that matched, you know, the color of cotton against, you know, the soil that was depleted. And they also describe them as old before their time, as wrinkled, with distended bellies. So they began to see poor whites as a diseased breed, as clinical subjects. And over again, they sort of assumed that these poor whites were people that could not be incorporated into the economy. And they began to see them as physically, mentally inferior. Even to slaves, where slaves could be trained, slaves could be used. Now, it doesn't diminish the fact that planters at times often used racist rhetoric, the same thing I talked about that Lyndon Johnson was talking about, where they, at the time of the Civil War, they would say, well, we have to oppose, you know, Lincoln. We have to propose the emancipation of slaves because that somehow will make poor whites equal to freed blacks. But in fact, if you look at the structure of Southern society and you looked at what planters actually said, they in no way embraced poor whites. They had nothing to do with them. They didn't marry with them. They didn't socialize with them. They didn't go to church with them. And they viewed them as a dangerous element. And they saw them as particularly dangerous during the Civil War. Many prominent Confederates felt that poor whites were going to rise up against them. They were going to be tempted by the promises of free land or democracy that was much more pervasive in the northern states and would be offered by Abraham Lincoln and his party.
Well, certainly that phrase, white working class, has been a recurring theme in this year's presidential election, mainly because Donald Trump's message has reportedly been resonating with them, enjoying something like a 67-68% level of support from that particular demographic. And we want to give some historical context to that as we continue to talk to Nancy Eisenberg, and we want to hear from you. Please give us a call, 1-866-798-8255-866-798-TALK, or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we got a call from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito, and she wrote, couldn't stay on the line, but she wants you to touch on the nexus of class history, eugenics, and people with disabilities.
Yes, I mean, this is the other, I think, you know, one of the most darkest chapters in American history. We tend not to understand that the eugenics movement did not start in Germany. It was not the Nazis. In fact, the leading proponents of the eugenics movement were in the United States and Great Britain. And in fact, academics, scientists, the military, and as I already mentioned, politicians as prominent as Theodore Roosevelt were unabashed advocates of a national campaign to weed out inferior stock. The danger that they saw and that they repeated over and over again was of sacrificing pedigree, the expressed fear of indiscriminate breeding among poor whites that threatened to bring down the entire Anglo-Saxon race. In 1913, Roosevelt wrote the head of the Eugenics Records Office, arguing that degenerates must not be permitted, quote, to reproduce their kind. By 1931, 27 states had sterilization laws on the books, and eugenic courses were being added to college curriculum. Intellectual testing and pedigree charts were in vogue. And then, of course, there's the important landmark case of 1927 of the Supreme Court, Buck v. Bell, where it was all framed about defending the right to sterilize a poor white woman. That was Carrie Buck, and she was described as the shiftless, ignorant, and worthless class of antisocial whites in the South. And Carrie Buck was chosen for sterilization because she was the perfect specimen of white trash. And that's the other thing we forget. Most of the most targeted group for sterilization in the eugenics movement were poor white women.
Well, certainly tackling issues of race and class and poverty to this day remains a big taboo in the U.S., but we're going to tackle it today with Nancy Eisenberg. We're going to take a break. Nancy, stay with us, and we hope you'll give us a call and join the conversation. This is your call.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, just a half an hour from now here on 91.7 KALW.
Welcome back. I'm Renee Kemp, and today we're talking to Nancy Eisenberg. She's the author of White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Let's go straight to the phones. KDF in Oakland, good morning.
Thank you very much. You know, I was called tacky by a well-known environmentalist during the time I was maintaining, holding up the feminist newspaper of record, Plexus West Coast Women's Press. We published from 1974 to 1986. Meanwhile, there is currently an economic crisis facing journalism. So I just wanted to call in and say, so me and other white, me and other trash women, white and black, did something that upper middle class and Ivy Leaguers don't seem to be able to do or be willing to do, and that is to work, and then after work, do all the work necessary to publish our 24 to 36 page monthly newspaper, first person pyramid form journalism. And to this day, us trash women continue to be the target of dismissal by women who stand on our shoulders while spitting in our face. There's no respect for the history we created. And I'm so glad you wrote this book. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Nancy, it looks like she's thrilled to embrace the whole idea of white trash, where it used to be a pejorative. Now, suddenly, it's actually not just her input, but everything from Here Comes Honey Boo Boo to Duck Dynasty is now, it's part of the national culture, and it's being embraced even by celebrities from Dolly Parton to Bill Clinton. They love the idea that this is part of their heritage.
No, I'm glad that the author talked about gender tension, because that's the other thing. We have to realize that class tensions are not only between, you know, elite men and poor men, which is really what's been the focus of the discussion around the Trump campaign. But there are also class tensions between elite women and working class women and poor women, because class is also very much defined by how we think about who's a proper woman. What are the standards that we use to measure female beauty? That's class defined. I have a section where I talk particularly about Tammy Faye Baker and Dolly Parton. And there's a really wonderful scholar who's done this wonderful work on Dolly Parton and talked about how her stage performance, and, you know, she's known for her big hair, her large chest, her outlandish outfits. She argued that part of what Dolly Parton, and she wrote about this in her memoir, was saying, the scholar referred to it as excessive womanliness, in part because Dolly Parton spent growing up poor white, with barely nothing to eat, being bullied by men. She felt that when she finally made it, she wanted to sort of declare out loud so there would be no doubt that she was a woman. And this is what we forget. Poor white women throughout history were described as toothless, haggard, and barely seen as being women at all.
And Bill Clinton has embraced the whole idea of being the man from Hope, where he talked about being barefoot, not sure who his father was. It's actually being embraced as part of the national discussion.
Yeah, it's really mixed. I mean, I think it's still mixed today because, I mean, Bill Clinton, for example, we forget he was viciously attacked as white trash. He was mocked. And the one thing that saved him was when he embraced the spirit of Elvis Presley And he was known for, you know, that key moment when he was on the Arsenio Hall show and he pulled out his saxophone and played Heartbreak Hotel. This was seen as a more positive way to identify with his poor white roots because Elvis is a really unique phenomena. He was seen as the country boy who made good. And Elvis is also interesting because he was called a hillbilly cat. So he embraced both African-American notions of music and identity as well as poor identity. But no one at the time, I mean, even when Bill Clinton was president, he was still being vilified by Republicans as not having the right pedigree to be president. This was essentially the argument, especially when he was carried to Ronald Reagan, who was seen by his promoters as, you know, a fatherly king-like figure. And this was sort of almost cast as the prince versus the pauper. So we don't want to sort of erase that past. But it is true. I spend a lot of time talking about the 70s, and there's this idea of recovering redneck roots. And I think there's a difference, and even we can see in the categories, the class categories, between redneck and white trash, where redneck are connected more to the old yeoman notion. They were also seen as, you know, the more identified with the working class. There still were negative connotations, particularly even into the 1950s or even as earlier in the 1930s, rednecks were still seen as people who were viciously racist and attacked not only blacks but elite whites who supported civil rights. So you have that idea of recovering redneck roots because in the 70s, all Americans were looking for a genuine identity. You had the growth of identity politics. You had Alex Haley's roots. You had people writing about recovering the Jewish ghetto. So, of course, what came as a part of that, in a way, is a backlash against the eugenics movement, which said that you inherited this derogatory identity from your past, from your relatives. There was a shift to say that identity was something cultural, something that you could embrace, that you could remember the positive associations. So you even have people in the 80s writing white trash cookbooks, the same way we talk about ethnic food as a celebration of your identity. But this was, you know, this also coexisted side by side with the continuation of really, really vicious portrayals of poor whites. And the best example of that was the book Deliverance and the film Deliverance, where you had this really horrible portrayal of you know, hillbillies who were seen as sexually deviant. And that's another trait that gets attached to the poor. Trailer trash are seen as women were described as trailer tramps. So this idea that sexual deviance still echoes those old eugenic notions that somehow poor whites engaged in wayward breeding.
And there, I do remember, too, during some of Bill Clinton's darkest days when Jennifer Flowers accused him of inappropriate behavior, one of his aides said, you know, when you drag a dollar bill through a trailer park, you never know what you're going to get, trying to undermine what she was saying based on her class.
Yeah. And that's really funny because, you know, Ken Starr, when he put together his famous report investigating the Monica Lewinsky scandal, you know, mentioned sex 500 times. And people began to say, well, of course, you know, this he was trying to equate, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors with low class lewdness. And at the time, people basically said, well, of course, Clinton got involved in this kind of scandal because they saw it as, you know, coming from his working class, lower class roots, that this was just sort of another story drawn from the pulp fiction of trailer trash.
What a fascinating take. 866-798-TALK is the number, and the lines are full. Folks are really interested in this, partially, I think, Nancy, because this whole notion of poor white Americans playing a role in our current elections is on the front of people's minds. So by all means, give us a call. Let's go to Jan in Hayward. Good morning, Jan.
Good morning. Thank you. This is such an important topic. I would love to know, it seems I have read somewhere in the past that there was a point in time or area, I don't know, but there were some black people and white people, I don't know if they were in the, you know, what particular era, but it seemed like they were trying to come together to organize something for themselves, and it was broken up, and I wondered, the combination of people in a certain class like that coming together, has that been really, quote unquote, allowed to happen?
Well, it's an interesting question because, frankly, there are those who argue that, Nancy, that Martin Luther King was no threat as long as he was talking about racial issues. But when he began talking about economic issues and marching with the garbage workers in Tennessee and trying to draw the line between poor whites and blacks, that he became a threat to whoever.
Yeah, no, the caller and your comment fit perfectly. The movement she's referring to is the populist movement, where there was an effort to join the interests of poor whites and poor blacks. It was a movement that was seriously attacked, and one of its prominent leaders ended up returning to using racist language to divide those two groups because it was perceived as so threatening. And yes, Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign of 1967-68 was an attempt to break down that divide because he knew that poverty was a tool that was used to divide the interests of poor whites and poor blacks. And we also forget that not only have we had, you know, has our democracy been threatened by never embracing universal suffrage? We know all about the efforts to disfranchise Americans today with the voter ID laws, but the most successful way of disenfranchising Americans in history was the infamous poll tax that was first passed under the Jim Crow era, and it not only divested poor blacks, but poor whites of the right to vote. So this is, in a sense, not only have the interests of poor whites and poor blacks been united, but that effort to make sure that there's always a wedge to pit them against one another has always been a part of, you know, the uglier side of our democratic past. And unfortunately, the group that I spend a lot of time talking about when I talk about poor rural whites, recently there were articles written in the Washington Post talking about the widespread poverty, the problems with drug addiction, the poor health of people who live in rural areas. And I think that this is the other problem we tend to have, is that we ignore what life is like in rural areas because it's not front and center. It's not covered on the news. And we think of poverty, and this started in the 60s, where we tended to think all poverty was connected to cities and the ghettos and African Americans. But at the same time, there were large numbers of poor whites from Appalachia and other areas who were migrating to Chicago, Cincinnati, and creating what were called hillbilly ghettos. Mm. So we in a sense tend to ignore the way the interests of not only poor blacks and poor whites are actually combined because they are often discriminated in identical ways, but we also forget, and this is one of the problems that I think is most dangerous, we can't equate white privilege with class privilege. We can't assume that all white people have the same privileges. They don't. They don't have the same educational opportunities. They don't live in the same neighborhoods, as I referred to with suburbia. We live in class zone neighborhoods, and if you live in a nice neighborhood, it's safer. You have all the amenities, so class divides us in terms of where we live. And we have to sort of stop assuming that when we talk about the difficulties faced by African Americans in this country, we have to acknowledge that often it is poor blacks who are the focus of the most abuse and most mistreatment. And we have to sort of understand that class is still a very important category, that if we really want to change our democracy, if we really want to embrace the way our society is structured, we have to look at both race and class.
Let's go to Bill in San Francisco, and your comment dovetails nicely into exactly what Nancy was just saying. Bill, good morning.
Good morning. I'm loving the discussion. Sometime last fall, I saw a small article talking about the demographic group that's dying off in numbers significantly higher than would have been expected and historically, and that was middle-aged, white, no college education, that they were dying off significantly. And I was talking with a coworker who was originally from Little Rock. And, you know, some of the things that were being talked about was substance abuse, loss of jobs, and I don't mean just individual loss of jobs, the disinvestment in American cities and other areas, rural areas. And he said, you could be describing Little Rock by that article.
I remember this study, Nancy, I'm sure you're familiar, and it talked about the levels of suicide among middle-aged white men, poor health leading to premature death, and Greg's position is that clearly the idea is that poor white males are in the crosshairs in this country.
No, I think one of the points that he's referring to, which is, I think, something that Americans have to seriously reevaluate. We allow cities, we allow towns, we allow rural areas. I mean, this is talked a lot about with the Rust Belt, but it's all over this country to die. We fail to acknowledge that when, and I highlight this because it's the theme that goes all the way back to British colonization. We allow what were once productive areas to become wastelands. And what do you think happens with the people who live there? I wrote a piece where I was critiquing the National Review article that was written by Kevin Williamson, where he basically, you know, attacked the Trump supporters as people coming from dying communities, and he again described them as addicted to drug, experiencing family and sexual dysfunction. But then he went on to argue, he basically argued that what these people should do is just move. And that, again, goes back to the same idea that Franklin was talking about. Yeah, just pack your bags, take to the road, and move. But that is really ridiculous because it's what if you have bought a home? That investment is gone. What if you have friends and neighbors and you're struggling to survive? And the idea that people, just like businesses, can just get up and leave is really short-sighted. And in fact, what we really need to think about, if we were going to really look at changing the American economy, it's not only, you know, it's certainly not building a wall, but it's about how do you, in productive ways, reinvest into American communities, or even if a community is suffering, how do you make that transition possible so that people are not destroyed, that their lives are not destroyed? And how do we address areas that are not economically productive? And there's no effort to, you know, bring in new businesses, to rebuild those communities. And that the fact that you mentioned that this is going on in Little Rock is happening everywhere. And it's really part of what I talk about, this bigger problem of how our country, it's not just divided into regions, it's not just north and south. We live in class-zoned areas. So some people have all the benefits, all the perks. And we know that this is true, too, because there are stories about young couples who live in cities and they have to raise their kids, and they want to find the perfect town, the safe town to raise their kids. Well, they can do that if they have the wherewithal and the money to buy a house in a safe neighborhood. But that opportunity is not available to all, and we have to really think about how can we rebuild communities by breaking down those class barriers and recovering those areas that we've allowed to turn into wasteland and reinvest in them so that people who are there are not forgotten.
Okay, let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Again, kind of bringing it from the 1500s and the history of poor and working white people in this country to the present and today's presidential campaign. Greg, Palo Alto, good morning.
Hello, thank you. A couple of questions. One, why do you think that people, the majority of people in this country, do not see themselves in terms of class? Overwhelmingly, people vote against their class interest. They don't even see themselves in terms of class, and it's not even discussed that way. Even Bernie Sanders only talked about income inequality. He did not talk about poverty or lower class. The emphasis was on middle class. This was not even brought up at either the Republican or Democratic conventions, the whole issue of poverty. I never heard anybody mention it. So I'm just curious about that, about why class is, because there are tens of millions of people who live in poverty and would be considered, I guess, quote-unquote, lower class. So I'm just curious about that.
Nancy, is it the aspirational nature of folks to want to feel like if they're not in the middle class now, they can maybe get there?
Well, it's mixed. I mean, we know today that there are 19.17 million Americans below the poverty line. That's 42.1% who are white. And I think that there's several things going on. Yes, I think that politicians, I mean, even Bernie Sanders did at one point in the campaign say something like, well, we don't talk about the poor because they don't vote. And in a sense, he was being, unfortunately, honest, because the middle class has been the long-standing rhetoric that we all want to be in the middle class, that the middle class, we just have to find the way to move up the ladder. But there's really a problem with that, because I think one of the reasons we don't talk about class, I talk about the whole myths we tell ourselves, and we forget that politics is often about ideology. It's about presenting to people what they want to hear. It's about celebrating a sense of inclusion as opposed to, as I said, there's a darker politics, which is the other side, about emphasizing divisions and emphasizing that you're in a zero-sum game, and if you give advantages to one group, you're going to lose. So you have both of those traditions. But the mythic side is to downplay the importance of class. The idea, as I said, that goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, goes all the way back that we broke from the class system in Great Britain at the time of our revolution. And that mythology has been, you know, fabricated over and over again. And journalists have found that when they interview people, most people don't like to describe themselves as being poor or being lower class. And even working class now has become a taboo word. Because in a sense, this is that other really dark side that we also inherited from the British, that we assume that people who have not made it into the working, into the middle class, somehow seen as failures. There's and people who write, like Dorothy Allison and others who write about poor whites in the 20th century, highlight there's an incredible amount of shame associated with being associated with the poor, associated with the lower class. And that's something that also makes it very difficult for Americans to talk about it. I also think politicians at times don't talk about it because, in a sense, they are interested in, you know, trying to reach the widest audience, and in a sense, don't want to deal with the really divisive issues. And class is extremely divisive in the same way race is. But Americans really need to open up their eyes and realize we have less social mobility in this country than in many countries in Europe. We are no longer the land of opportunity.
Were we ever? That's my point.
We have never been the land of opportunity, but we've told ourselves over and over again. I mean, even the immigrant myth. When we talk about migration, we assume that migration equalizes people. Well, people who came into this country as immigrants, they came from different class backgrounds. They didn't arrive here as equals. Some came in storage. Some came in cabins. So we have to sort of recognize that our country. And I think it's even more, it is an important thing to remember today that your class identity starts when you are a child. Right now, sociologists have found the most important predictor of success in this country is the wealth and privileges not only that you get from your parents, but your ancestors. So in a sense, we have recreated today the old world aristocracies. Our upper middle class parents give over 50% of their wealth to their children to make sure they have the best education, to make sure they have every perk and privilege. Whereas if you go to countries like Denmark and Sweden, even Japan, when a society provides more social services, then you're not as dependent on the wealth from your parents. So that's, I think, the thing that Bernie Sanders missed. Yes, the 1% has there's a gross concentration of wealth in the 1%, but we also have to deal with the ideology of the middle class. Middle class people don't want to acknowledge the privileges they have. They want to say, well, I made it on my own. I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. Or we have to acknowledge that when we use the term middle class, it's always being contrasted to the lower class. There is no middle class without comparing it to a lower class.
Well, the fact that that discussion was completely left out of this particular campaign, it has so far, I just think it's extraordinary since, according to the last census, something like 47 million Americans are living below the poverty line. Is it true that it's because they don't vote that they're just not even part of the discussion right now?
Well, yeah, I think there is an awareness on part of politics. I mean, look what politicians do. They poll people. We've had a really conscious effort to disenfranchise the poor. I mean, think about voter ID laws. When you limit the early voting or you make it harder for people to vote, people who have to work for a living don't have the luxury of just taking off to go get an ID to vote when they eliminate same-day voting. Or when you assume everyone has a car so you can use your driver's license. Well, we found, you know, recently in the North Carolina case that was North Carolina law, the voter ID law, which was turned down because they actually did studies. Politicians did studies and found that this form of ID was something that African Americans didn't have. So there's a real conscious effort to disenfranchise the poor. And I think that a lot of people feel that politicians aren't talking to them, that they are talking to some mythological middle-class person that isn't speaking across the class spectrum.
Well, Nancy, I appreciate that you brought the discussion literally from the 1500s right up to the current elections. It's extraordinary, and it's been a great conversation. I wish we had gotten to more of the calls. People really are interested in this subject, and it has been a wonderful discussion. Nancy Eisenberg, author of White Trash, 400 Years of Untold History of Class in America. Thank you, Nancy, so much. Sorry that we weren't able to get to your calls, but by all means, if you're able to, you can go to our website, yourcallradio.org, and you can post comments and continue the conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to be here. And tune in tomorrow when Rose Aguilar will be back. She'll discuss modernizing the Toxic Substances Control Act. So that's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you tomorrow. I'm Renee Kemp. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.